Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It's great to be back on the air. It's hard to believe that it was probably around a week ago this time that we finished the series on Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy. And that was quite a journey, quite an excellent story, to say the least. But there's good news to report. Now that we've ended another series, we will officially be starting a new series, being that I'm on the air and I have got everything ready to go for our next podcast book series topic. So I'm sure many of you are just really wondering, how soon was Kirk going to get back on the air? How soon would he be ready to go with another brand new, exciting podcast book series topic discussion? Well, that time is now. And hey, I'm not going to complain about that. But what I do know, too, is that with our next book topic podcast series, it's an important piece of history that has been overlooked. It's been on one end, part of a greater conflict that has actually been forgotten. In other words, most of us who are familiar with the topic that we will be discussing are familiar with it overall. But from a battle perspective, you know, we may know of certain battles, but yet there are some that have hidden stories to tell where the outcome turned out to be a lot bigger than most of us could have ever imagined, if that's the best way to sum it up. So I think sometimes, like I said, I think when we often learn about certain topics, we think that we know all the nuts and bolts, but we do forget that there are other nuts and bolts out there that have not been fully told to the best of their ability. And so therefore, I feel that it's necessary that that this particular podcast book topic series that we're going to be delving into is one that should be addressed, one that is of significant relevance, not only for the time in which it happened, but perhaps for the greater well-being of the United States. I'm sure, based upon what I've just described a second ago, that some of you are probably thinking, does this pertain to the United States Civil War that took place between 1861 and 1865? The answer is no. But I will tell you that what took place, it took place well before the Civil War began, but it took place in the early part of the 19th century. You know, I also should point out that it is hard to believe that for those of us living in the United States, that Super Bowl Sunday is just around the corner. And to think at one time there was no such thing as the Super Bowl. I was certainly hoping that the Detroit Lions were going to be able to go all the way and make it to the Super Bowl. But the fact that they did win two playoff games, which they hadn't done in a long time, is remarkable. I know that there are a handful of teams out there who've never won a Super Bowl. And here we are going into Super Bowl 58. The Super Bowl began back in 1967. One has to wonder, for those teams that have never won a Super Bowl before, will we live long enough to see some of those teams break their will we live long enough to see them break their own personal curses? I mentioned the Detroit Lions, for example, because I had learned some time back that back in the late 1950s, around, I think it was 57, it was the last time they won a championship, and that was before the Super Bowl. They traded their star quarterback, Bobby Lane. He told the owners and the team that, given that you all have traded me, I'm going to put a curse on you all. I will see to it that you never win another playoff game without me. Well, at one point, folks, the Detroit Lions went over 30 years before they won a playoff game back in the 90s, I want to say it was. So the scary part is that curses do work, and it's not always a good thing, but From a sports history standpoint, I would certainly hope that some of us, you know, if we're really that big into the game of professional football, that we might live long enough to see some curses be broken. Of course, my wife and I are big Pittsburgh Steelers fans, as I've mentioned before. And the last time the Steelers won a Super Bowl was 15 years ago in 2009. And the last time they played in one was 13 years ago in 2011. I certainly hope that at some point down the road, I'll see my Pittsburgh Steelers back in a Super Bowl. And I certainly would love to be able to see them. I would certainly hope that I'll be able to watch them one day win a seventh Super Bowl. I'm sure it'll happen, but who knows? You know, we have to keep in mind that there was a time when dynasties were prevalent because there was no such thing as free agency. The Steeler dynasty of the 70s was a primary great example. Well, I think it's important that given with the prologue that we have before us, and it is a six-pager, folks, it is fair to say that we better get this show on the road, because if I keep rambling on about other stuff that, you know, is significant, I might lose time and lose complete hindsight of what message I need to relay to you all, given that we're starting a new podcast book topic series. So here we begin with the prologue to our new discussion, and at the end, I will reveal the actual title of the book that we're going to be discussing. Whenever we're learning about the War of 1812, we must be reminded that the United States as a nation was fighting for its independence from an economic and existence standpoint against England, whose military presence by land and water reigned supreme. Did you hear that, folks? We're going to be talking, we're going to be doing another podcast book topic series about the War of 1812, which has often been referred to as America's Forgotten War. Yes, folks, we did have to fight a second war for independence against England. It's so easy to forget. As a matter of fact, I can back it up as to why it's easy to forget. So how about we continue to proceed? It's very fair to admit that most people often assume delegates from the United States and Great Britain peacefully resolved their differences during negotiation talks resulting in the 1783 Paris Treaty, which officially ended the Revolutionary War nearly 30 years earlier. So yes, isn't it fair to say that what the textbooks told us years ago, that when the Treaty of Paris was conducted in 1783, of course, we probably do need to be reminded that in late 1782, the first rounds of discussion probably began. These peace talks and agreements just didn't happen overnight, and everybody went their own way and lived happily ever after. That's not how it happened. And I know most of you are wondering, well, you know, if the Treaty of Paris officially ended the Revolutionary War, why are the United States and Britain at war again 30-some years later? Well, before we can refocus our energies on what is going on in the lead-up to the War of 1812 and after the War of 1812 begins, we do have to look back to the past, because often we do have to look back to the past in order to understand what is going on in the present. Regardless of matter, while Britain agreed to acknowledge that her former subjects, aka the 13 colonies, were to be treated as free and independent states, the United States on her end adhered to eliminating further seizures of all property belonging to loyalists. Loyalists from the American Revolution, folks, those whom were loyal to king and country. The government was under the notion that it was okay to crack down on those whom were not patriotic, that it was okay to confiscate their property without their consent. I mean, after all, didn't we separate? Wasn't one of the grievances filed against King George III about taxation without representation? In other words, he's, you know, taxing us without our consent. Yes. So is it fair to say that loyalists Yes, we may not like the fact that they are loyal to king and country, but should the other side be confiscating their property without their consent, all in the name of loyalty? No. But the Americans, or the United States, delegates from the United States, agreed to eliminate further seizures of all property belonging to loyalists. And both sides agreed to have prisoners of war, per the opposing sides, be released. Although this treaty did see some success take place, or some successes take place, I should say, I think it's fair to say that not all treaties benefit everyone. Some things benefit both sides, but sometimes we do forget that not everybody walks away with everything that they proposed on the table. You might be lucky if you walk away with 50% of what you had proposed. But although this treaty did see some successes take place, Great Britain, however, violated its promise to surrender existing control of military forts within United States territory, as she still retained troops at six forts along the Great Lakes from New York State. And I'm sure some of you are wondering, well, where would British forts have been located in New York State? I'll give you one, for example, Fort Niagara in Youngstown, just north of Niagara Falls. I know this one because when my wife and I vacationed in Niagara Falls, it'll be 6 years ago this April. And believe me, it was very cold even for that time. We spent a day touring Fort Niagara. It is very well worth visiting. And for those of you who have never been to Fort Niagara, it is something that you should not miss, especially if you are an avid history buff and want to learn everything there is to know about the fort. It is strongly worth visiting. So Fort Niagara was one of the six forts where British troops were still retained, and the British had obviously violated their promise to surrender existing control of the military forts within the United States territory, given that there were troops at six forts along the Great Lakes, as I mentioned, from New York State and as well as into present-day states of Ohio and Michigan. So think about it, folks. Those New York State and then the territories of what would then have been Michigan and Ohio, all of those areas have comprised a total of six military forts. But then there are two additional forts located along Lake Champlain's northern end. We have to wonder, how in the world is the United States going to be able to get the British out of these areas? Think about it, folks. Britain's military is far more superior than the United States's, even in the aftermath of the 1783 Paris Treaty. Well, believe it or not, folks, another 11 years would go by until British Army units stationed at forts along the Northwest Territory reluctantly agreed to disperse. In other words, to abandon. This happened under what was called the Jay Treaty of November 1794, which was part of a broader peace agreement aimed to relieve post-Revolutionary War conflicts between Britain and the United States that had not been fully resolved in the years since the Revolutionary War ended. The Jay Treaty was named after John Jay, whom would also go on to be one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, him and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. John Jay was quite a brilliant individual, to say the least, had a very solid, impeccable record of government service. But what makes John Jay's treaty unique for the time in which it took place was that his treaty in the long run that he helped negotiate was responsible for ushering in 10 years of peaceful trade between the United States and Great Britain. 10 years. You know, it's one thing to have 10 years of peaceful trading relations, but now we're having to wonder, Where did all this go wrong? Why did the peaceful trading relations come to an end? Well, I can tell you it didn't happen with a light switch overnight. Prior to Congress approving John Jay's treaty, and of course we must be reminded that while yes, there are two bodies of Congress, being the House of Representatives and the Senate, only one body has the power to debate treaties, negotiate, and has the power to ratify treaties, and that is the upper house, being the Senate. So prior to Congress approving John Jay's treaty, being the Senate, American ships and their crew were constantly harassed and captured by the enemy, Great Britain. It got to the point, folks, where roughly 300 neutral American merchant vessels got seized without any advanced warnings. Some of you are probably wondering, why in the world are sailors in our vessels, those aboard the vessels, why are they being captured? What's going on here? Don't we have rights on the high waters? Well, although the Jay Treaty in the end helped modify relations with United States and Britain regarding trade practice relations, it also fueled further partisanship between the Federalists. Of course, when I think of the Federalists, I think of men like George Washington, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, just to name a few, and the Democratic Republicans being that of Thomas Jefferson. These are our first two political parties, and we should be reminded that even when George Washington, right before he stepped down from the high office of the presidency, he warned about the dangers of political parties. He warned about the dangers of what factions themselves can bring about as a result of political parties. Washington was not a big fan of these parties. It's one thing to be a Federalist or a Democratic Republican, but if you're not careful and you cause trouble and you tend to be partisan versus acting in a bipartisan manner, well, partisanship can, if gone unchecked, partisanship can reach extreme levels to where nothing gets accomplished. So, yes, the Jay Treaty did help modify relations between the United States and Britain regarding trade practice relations, but yet it fueled, as mentioned earlier, it did fuel further partisanship between Federalists and Democratic Republicans as to where the young republic should be aligned with from a foreign nation perspective. If you're the Federalists, 9 times out of 10, you're going to align yourself with Britain. If you're the Democratic Republicans, you are more pro-France. And of course, in George Washington's presidency, about 1793 it was, he oversaw our ability to stay out of overseas affairs. In other words, we became neutral. And that was one of the things that upset the Democratic Republicans. They wanted to be allies with France. Well, here's the problem. You ally yourself with France, then basically you are burning bridges with the British. And had we allied ourselves with France, the Jay Treaty would probably have never gone into effect. And of course, this partisanship would carry over into the start of the 19th century. Of course, partisanship still even exists today, but I think it's fair to say that when our forefathers were around, and yes, there was extreme acts of partisanship, they also didn't have a 24/7 news media like we have today. Come 1806, Thomas Jefferson was well into the start of his second term as the United States' third president, which also meant that the United States and British diplomats had to renew the Jay Treaty from George Washington's presidency. Although James Monroe, whom was the U.S. ambassador to Britain, including his associate William Pinckney, despite the fact that these two men had crafted the Monroe-Pinckney Treaty, which sought to have the British government abandon the practice of impressing American sailors from their ships. Impressment, folks, is where one side, out of nowhere, forces their way onto the enemy's ship and seizes sailors without their consent and take them, really in a sense, as hostages by forcing them to fight on the enemy's side. And of course, I will tell you all more here shortly as to why Britain was doing this. It wasn't something that they had just started overnight. I can tell you this much. It had been a practice that they had been doing for some time, even before the American Revolution began, if that tells you anything right there. But not just the practice of impressing American sailors from their ships, but how about addressing all neutral trading rights of American vessels in the midst of the Napoleonic Wars, which stemmed from the aftermath of the French Revolution, which resulted in the ouster of Louis XVI and his wife Marie Antoinette. Then on top of the French Revolutionary Wars, the British basically refused to abandon impressment as they claimed their navy was short of manpower on the high seas. Okay, yes, we might have the mightiest navy, but yet we're struggling to fulfill the numbers back home. So what are we going to do instead? We're going to basically not only capture enemy ships, but we're going to take all the as many able-bodied men as there are, even if it means forcing them against their own will off their ship, just so that we can make up for a deficit. Make up for a deficit. Of course, when I think of deficit, I think of, you know, money shortage. But a deficit in this case is lacking the sufficient means of supplying your ships with enough adequate sailors, being that of the British. So yes, for the British, they refused to abandon impressment as they claimed their navy was short of manpower on the high seas. Despite the Monroe-Pinckney Treaty being signed on December 31st, 1806, come March of 1807, President Jefferson read over the treaty, but he didn't send it to the Senate for approval. This, folks, was on the grounds of impressment and neutral trading rights. Britain's inability to acknowledge, including refusal of trying to modify U.S. concerns regarding impressment and neutral trading rights along the high seas, were just some examples behind what contributed come 1812 when Congress declared war, but doing so under intense partisanship. Well, folks, you know, we all like to think that when Congress declares war, that everybody's on the same page, regardless of party affiliation. But we should be reminded in 1812, not everyone's all gung-ho about going to war or even the thought of declaring war against England. And there are many reasons for it. And doesn't that bear resemblance as to what was taking place 36 years earlier in the crucial weeks leading up to that final declaration? In other words, yes, there were those whom wanted separation from England, but yet there were those whom still remained a bit skeptical. In other words, what happens if we do separate from England? And let's say, you know, okay, we declare our independence. What are we going to replace? What are we going to replace this all with? And who's to say that if we come up with our own system of government, that come a year from now, we're going to be 100% better than we were before? So for those whom are against the notion of wanting to go to war against Britain in 1812, it could be for economic reasons. It could be for the fact that maybe we don't have a strong enough army to take on the world's most powerful army. Those are just some of a handful of examples as to why there are those whom are skeptical about perhaps wanting to even vote for declaring war. The United States was just shy of turning 36 years old as an independent nation when President James Madison, on June 18, 1812, signed into law a formal declaration of war against Britain, making the event itself unique, given it marked the first time that the young republic declared war on another country. Only five times, folks, has it ever happened where Congress has officially declared war. The War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, and both World Wars I and II. Congress as an entire body was fully opposed to Britain's actions involving impressment, forced recruitment, to improperly aiding Indians within the Northwest Territory. In other words, the presence of British troops along the Northwest Territory, they had partnerships with multiple Indian tribes as far away as what we know as present-day Wisconsin. And this all stemmed back from the aftermath of the French and Indian War when the French were forced to give up their land holdings in present-day Ohio and Michigan. The British obviously took over those relations and, of course, went about imposing measures that prohibited westward expansion for her own subjects, you know, being the 13 colonies. You know, prior to the war ending, we were promised that that should we emerge victorious, which we would, which was the intention, that that you all, the subjects, whom have a claimed stake in any land holdings west of the Appalachians, you all will be allowed to establish new settlements. Well, that didn't happen. The British reneged on the promise given to the subjects, being the colonies, the 13 colonies, and that was just one of a handful of factors as to what would eventually cause the severing of official ties between the colonies and the crown. But as for the British, one of the objectives, and it will be mentioned again somewhere down the road, but I'll tell you here, as to why they are improperly aiding Indians in the eyes of the young republic, is that Britain wants to establish a buffer territory in the United States. In other words, Britain wants to establish a territory that would be confined to just Indians only, and Britain wants to prohibit any further westward expansion past what we know as present-day Ohio. Well, of course, in 1812, Ohio was already a state. She was admitted 9 years earlier in 1803 into the Union. So, yes, Congress as an entire body is fully opposed to Britain's actions involving impressment, that is the forced recruitment, to improperly aiding Indians within Northwest Territory. But what Madison's administration did not know, it wouldn't learn until late July, pertained to British concessions, which sought to prevent war. Well, by the time this news got obtained, war was already declared and there was no turning back. Yeah, think about it, folks. We don't have telephones. We don't have a breaking news app alert that says Congress has voted along party lines to declare war. And a week or two later, James Madison has signed this official declaration. So think about it. I'm sure that there were those, most notably amongst the Federalist camp, who probably pleaded with Madison to send some delegates overseas, or even not just maybe 3,000 miles across the ocean, but probably requested that delegates get sent into the Northwest Territory to try to come up with some kind of proper compromise that might be able to avert war altogether. But I think it's fair to say Madison just wasn't going to have any of it. Hey, another good example of partisanship right there. From the war's outset, starting after Congress's war declaration, Britain's Royal Navy went right to work by issuing a blockade on U.S. maritime trade, become early 1814 after French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte had abdicated his reign, did British naval officials send extra troops to North America, where the Royal Navy resumed its blockade against the United States via the maritime trade. And, of course, when we think of maritime trade, yes, it obviously involves the waters, but this is more than just sailing the waters. We're talking about the exchange of products through the use of vessels, including shipping lanes, ports, logistics, as well as any existing international trade agreements between two or more countries. All of this, folks, you know, not just the previous trade agreements from the Jay Treaty of 1794, but shipping lanes, ports, and logistics have all seen some major setbacks. And because through the Royal Navy engaging in numerous blockade tactical procedures, which have now ultimately gone about damaging the United States' economy in the midst of wartime. You know, it's easy to assume that when a nation's economy is in a recession, that, you know, more often than not, it's in a recession. There doesn't have to be a war going on. I think it's fair to say there have been times when a nation's economy is in a recession. It doesn't mean that the world itself is in a bad place, but in 1814, the world is chaotic. The world is a bit unpredictable, and the United States is seeing its economy go down in shambles, even in the midst of war. Well, whenever I hear about the year 1814, the first thing which triggers my mind, or I should say my thoughts, involving the War of 1812 is an event that took place on August 24th, the burning of Washington, D.C. Yes, folks, for those of you who are not familiar about the burning of Washington, D.C. from August 24th of 1814, I'm going to give you all a little bit of background information on this. And we should be reminded, well, I'll tell you all here soon. Maybe I shouldn't give it away, but we should be reminded that in 1814, Washington, D.C., obviously, for one, was nothing like it is today. Washington, D.C. was a wilderness. And there were those who were convinced that the British would never attack the nation's capital, given it was a wilderness and that it had nothing to offer. That's easier said than done. But I do know this, that if you don't defend your wilderness, in other words, if you don't defend the wilderness where your nation's capital is, if you don't properly take the necessary steps to modify the worst case scenario, then the wilderness itself becomes a sitting duck for the enemy, a complete sitting target, where it's not just a matter of if it could happen. It's a matter of when the inevitable could happen. So the British invasion of Washington, D.C. sadly resulted in British forces setting fire to multiple government military buildings, including the White House and the Capitol buildings. The only building that was spared, folks, was the Patent Office. Believe it or not, folks, only one government building was spared. Now, we're not talking 50 buildings, folks, in 1814. We're probably talking just shy of maybe 15 buildings at most. But we should be reminded that there were a lot of private residences in and around the government buildings that were burned, including the Capitol and the White House. Of course, the Capitol didn't look anything like it is today. There was no Washington Monument, folks. But I know many of you are wondering, why did the British burn Washington, other than the fact that it was our nation's capital? Well, most of us don't know this one. I know bits and pieces of it. There is a book written about the event that took place a year before 1814. It's called Capital in Flames. But what I'll tell you this much is the following, that that the reason why the British burned Washington, D.C., it was because it stemmed from a retaliation attack. Well, the British did it as part of a retaliation attack, I should say, given that United States forces from April of 1813 defeated British forces at the Battle of York in present-day Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Not only had British forces been defeated, that was bad enough, but between April 28th to the 30th of 1813, American officials lost control of the troops below them. The troops below them became undisciplined. They became, really, I should say, uncivilized. They acted in a They acted very radical. They acted very violent. They acted in an ungentlemanly-like manner, if you're on the side of the British. But American troops took matters into their own hands by setting fire to legislative assembly buildings and the government house, home to Upper Canada's lieutenant governor, and looted homes of everyday citizens. Now think about it, folks. Without any warning, your home gets burnt, set ablaze, and now you have nowhere to live. Let's say husband and wife have 5, 6 children, eight people in one home now are displaced. And it's just not 8 people. We're talking well over maybe 50 to 100 families being displaced. It's very possible. So obviously this infuriated Britain. It infuriated them to the point where they basically said, okay, if they come into our territory, not only beat us in a battle, but destroy our government buildings, just basically uproot people, in everyday citizens, from their homes, then we're going to take it to them sometime next year, and we will strike them at a target that will basically not only result in a catastrophic aftermath, but it will shake them psychologically to the point where they may not have it in them to want to fight us anymore. So while the Americans' actions from late April 1813 have largely been forgotten, the burning of Washington from August 24th, 1814 can be seen as something bearing resemblance to what happened on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, 187 years later. So keep in mind, folks, the events of September 11th, 2001, which to me is a day that will always live in infamy. Of course, when my grandparents were living, when Pearl Harbor happened on December 7th of 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed to Congress by saying, December 7th, 1941, a day that which will live in infamy. Well, I think we should all be reminded of the fact that each generation, or throughout the course of history, there have been events that bear significance or some kind of resemblance to what happened in modern-day times from September 11th, 2001. But prior to August 24th, 1814, the only other instance when a foreign power occupied the United States' capital was during the Revolutionary War, when British forces took over Philadelphia come October of 1777. Although the British controlled Washington, D.C. for nearly 26 hours, folks, they left a reign of terror and destruction. But little did they know, once returning to their vessels, given many of them endured damages from an intense storm following the burning, that a revival in patriotism amongst America's people would soon take epic stage from Baltimore, just north of D.C., all the way north to New York State, where America's fate lied at stake. Fate lying at stake? This must sound like something bigger than say what the textbooks told us years ago, folks. I mean, I do remember years ago learning about the burning of Washington, but I didn't know that we had, on our end, had done something wrong that obviously angered the British by burning government buildings in York, present-day Toronto, Ontario, where not only were government officials displaced, but looting of people's homes, everyday ordinary citizens, whose lives were uprooted in a short matter of time. Is it fair to say that even in the midst of a victory, that people get caught up in the moment, or I should say troops get caught up in the moment? And it's one thing to want to stick it to the enemy, but sometimes you better be careful as to how far you stick it to the enemy. Because if you're not careful and you don't recognize your boundaries, whatever you accomplished will eventually fade away to where it doesn't mean anything when the exact opposite happens to you. So in other words, it probably is fair to say that what we did to the British in York, Ontario, following the battle, and what the British did a year later in 1814 are classic examples of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Okay, you hurt us, we're going to hurt you back. So we don't always have to refer to Old Testament times for that adage. It's fair to say that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth has been in existence well past the times of Old Testament. Come September 11th, 1814. Did you hear that, folks? September 11th, 1814. 2 weeks and 3 days after the British burned Washington, D.C., a British naval fleet arrived into full view as it turned Cumberland Head, a peninsula that extended outward beyond Lake Champlain. Britain's naval fleet comprised of 4 fighting ships, 10 gunboats, 2 backup vessels, and a big warship being the 37-gun frigate HMS Confiance. Well, folks, if you do the math right there, that's probably about 17 ships. And the 37-gun frigate HMS Confiance is the granddaddy of them all. Britain's naval commander, Captain George Downey, he's a veteran officer of the British Navy. He was determined to trounce his opponent on their own home water. Why not? If you've got the world's strongest naval power, you've got everything to your advantage. So wouldn't it be fair to say that because you have everything to your advantage and people on their own home soil are on the run, they couldn't defend their own capital, that what is going here, that what will soon be taking place on Lake Champlain to us should be seen as a slam dunk victory. Who in their right mind would think that a nation that has declared war on us but yet doesn't have a disciplined army, what in their right mind would think that they could defeat an army that not only is the best in the world, while it may have its flaws, but at the same time, an army that that is comprised of individuals who have been in the army for some time and know how to fight, even when the going gets tough. Well, standing in Naval Commander Captain George Downey's way is American Commander Master Commandant Thomas McDonough, whom oversaw 4 warships and 10 gunboats. That's 14 ships total. Come the morning of September 11th, 1814, Thomas McDonough observed Captain Downey's fleet from the deck of the 26-gun Saratoga. But despite his promising military career upstart, he had not before commanded a warship in real combat. Wow. To me, this is the ultimate test here. One could say that if he hasn't, that if Master Commandant Thomas McDonough has, if he has not commanded a warship before in real-time combat, for one, what has he gotten himself into? And two, does he really even have the slightest chance of defeating the British? Does he even have the means of supplying the proper crew whom can go about doing the unthinkable and defeating a large British naval squadron? Along the shores of Plattsburgh stood a British army eager to overwhelm the enemy. On her own home soil, given British troop numbers, stood just over 8,000 strong. Do you hear that, folks? 8,000 strong, just over 8,000 strong. They were led by Senior Commander Sir George Prevost, whom had served in the Army for 35 years. Well, if you've served in the Army, in the British Army for 35 years, you obviously know a thing or two. You've taken on several positions, you've worked your way up the ladder, but this is your career. So if you've served in the Army for 35 years, you better get this one right. I mean, it's one thing to lose a battle, but you don't want to lose a battle where you have every advantage to your disposal. Positioned in three smaller forts and two blockhouses across the Saranac River in Plattsburgh stood an American troop force comprised of less than 1,800 Army-abled men, including multiple militia volunteers under the helm of Brigadier General Alexander Macomb, whom had minimal combat action and never led a large army into battle. To me, this sounds like David against Goliath. The British representing themselves as Goliath on Lake Champlain, and the Americans, you know, as David, who, you know, we have officers whom do have experience, whom have promising upstart careers, but now we're left to wonder, can these officers on the American side carry out their missions, even despite the fact that they are so heavily outnumbered? Are they going to be able to put up a fight? Are they going to give it everything there is without leaving anything on the table? Well, come September 11th, 1814, it was more than determining which side gained full naval control of Lake Champlain, including military possession of Plattsburgh, should in the event British forces were to prevail on September 11th, they would have full control of Lake Champlain, including all of northern New York. Following Britain's burning of Washington, D.C., British forces 4 days later, on August the 28th, burned Alexandria, Virginia. We must be reminded, folks, that Alexandria, Virginia, for a number of years, in colonial days and into a bulk of the 19th century, Alexandria, Virginia was a port town. As a matter of fact, folks, you know, Washington, D.C., given it was the nation's capital, people didn't really stay in D.C. a whole lot. On the weekends, many of the residents of D.C. would either go north to Baltimore or Annapolis, or they would go south to Arlington or Alexandria. They just referred to Washington as a real dump. Even John Adams did, folks, when he was returning from Massachusetts to Washington, D.C., because, you know, we do have to be reminded, folks, that Adams's presidency, he spent part of his time in Philadelphia, and the final year of his presidency, or the last couple of months of his presidency, were in Washington, D.C. But even John Adams himself said that Washington, D.C., where the new capital would be located, was a wilderness that simply just wasn't attractive. But besides what happened 4 days later at Alexandria, Virginia, sadly, the burning at Alexandria, Virginia happened without any enemy resistance. Basically, we gave the British Alexandria. This forced officials in Philadelphia and New York to raise troops for security defensive measures, not knowing if the British would make their way northward into Philadelphia and New York and what would become of those cities. Rumors spread even further that British troop reinforcements would go past Plattsburgh by attacking Sackett's Harbor, New York, on Lake Ontario. My wife and I have been to Sackett's Harbor, and that's a neat little village. We went there, we went to New York State's Thousand Islands region 4 years ago and spent a day in Sackett's Harbor. A lot of rich War of 1812 history there. For those of you who have not gone to Sackett's Harbor, I strongly recommend that you do so. Prior to and after Washington, D.C.'s burning, British forces had already ventured as far north as present-day Maine, controlling 100 miles of the coast, and to the south of Maine, Nantucket Island's people had already declared their neutrality. Besides Washington's buildings lying in a ruinous state, President James Madison's cabinet was totally out of sync. For one, John Armstrong, the war secretary, resigned in disgrace. And I do believe that I will make it a priority to mention his name more so in other podcast segment episodes for this series that we're going to be discussing. John Armstrong was one of those individuals who made some very bad, I'll tell you this much, he made some very bad, ill-fated decisions that had severe negative repercussions for, most notably for Washington, D.C. As for James Monroe, he's the Secretary of State, but in the aftermath of John Armstrong's resignation, James Monroe fulfilled two posts, Secretary of State, including Secretary of War. The Treasury and Naval Secretaries were soon to put in their resignations. Isn't that just lovely? Here your capital is in shambles, and you want to put in your resignation. I don't know, folks. I think it's fair to say even back then there were those whom were burnt out under some unforeseen trying circumstances, but it did go on. And lastly, the government was nearing a breaking point as it soon faced running out of money altogether. Gosh, don't we see that even today with the United States government? Not trying to sound negative, folks, but I know that the national debt's in the trillions. I think it's fair to say that in 1814, our national debt was nowhere in the trillions. But the bottom line is that the government's running out of money. And because the government's running out of money, can we afford to further fund this war? No, but something's got to be done. We've got to have some kind of revival, not just from a patriotism standpoint, but we got to have a revival in the sense that we need to score some huge victories, so that over time or within a short time frame, perhaps treaty talks can begin, and to where we'll come away on better modified terms. What truly mattered on September 11th, 1814, was that there stood an American presence of anchored ships in Plattsburgh Bay, including army and militiamen stationed in the town of Plattsburgh, ready to defend America, but more so her existence as a nation. Yes, folks, as mentioned earlier, the War of 1812 really, to me, was about not only improving America's economic rights in terms of being able to sail freely on the high waters. But really, this is about existence as a nation. We're trying to earn our respect along the high waters, but we're also trying to earn our respect as a nation. And by doing so, we need to, we still have a presence of British troops, not only in the Northwest Territory, we still have a presence of British troops in the Great Lakes, but the bottom line is we're still being kicked around. We're still being frowned upon. In other words, isn't it fair to say that America needs to grow up again? America needs to reinvent itself, but America also needs to perhaps do away with the notion that, well, you know, leading up to this war, many were divided and split over whether or not there should be a presence of a standing army. I'll mention that again at some point, but believe it or not, folks, there were many before this war even broke out whom did not like the presence of a standing army in times of peace. Well, it's one thing to have a time of peace, but a standing army does need to be present because you never know when that state of innocence can be taken from you. The army has to be ready to go. Well, folks, the prologue, or I should say that the title to this new book topic podcast series that we'll be discussing is The Battle of Lake Champlain. A Brilliant and Extraordinary Victory by John H. Schroeder. And I'm sure some of you are wondering, have you been to Champlain, New York before, Kirk? No, I haven't, but my wife and I, when we vacationed in the Adirondacks of New York State about 14 years ago, the closest we got to Lake Champlain, well, actually, I take it back. We did see Lake Champlain. We saw Lake Champlain from its southern end in a little village called Ticonderoga, which is home to Fort Ticonderoga. But so the answer to that question is yes, we have seen Lake Champlain, but we have not been to the village of Champlain before, but it would be worth visiting. But yes, that is the title to our new podcast series, folks, The Battle of Lake Champlain, A Brilliant and Extraordinary Victory. Well, I have no doubts that based upon what we have learned now, what we have learned through the prologue, that we are going to embark on a journey that will truly make us appreciate not only our existence as a nation, but what we nearly lost as a nation. Well, that covers it for this podcast segment episode. And when I'm on the air again next, we're going to begin talking about the indecisive Northern theater. So in other words, we're going to learn a little bit more about the United States' neighbor, one of the countries bordering the United States. I think it'd probably be fair to say that we probably already know which one that is. But we do need to know some reasons behind why decisions were made as to the militaristic approaches that the government took after declaring war on Britain. Well, thank you for your time as always, and wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe, and thank you again for being such ardent listeners. Without you all, I'm not sure where I would be, but you all have made a lot of this possible, and continue to get the word out to other people whom would like to know more about forgotten pieces of history, like, you know, America's Second War for Independence, being the War of 1812, it is very well worth learning about. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to being back on the air with you all soon.